Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Camera's gonna come on. Okay, here we go.
I'm ready.
Okay, it's on.
And the blue light's on.
Oh, the blue light's on. We're gonna open our hearing today, the 7th of February, for the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. And it's great to have everybody here. We don't have any possible introduction, any committee bills to introduce. So we're going to begin with an informational meeting. So I'm gonna open an informational meeting on an overview of the federal forest collaboratives and the forest stewardship contracting that's happening throughout Oregon. So with that, I will open that public hearing, and we'll have Brett come up, and Kurt and Mark and Pete all come on up to the front, and
Grab one, they're already got four chairs.
You make sure that as you get started, you make sure you identify who you are for the record and all of that, so. Again, thank you very much for being here, and we've heard good things, and we've heard issues where we wanna try to make, how do we make it better, and what can we do to, and from my perspective, it's figuring out how we keep infrastructure in the state of Oregon that we have to have if we're gonna be successful over the years. And I think this is a, at least in the east side, it's producing the opportunity at least to keep some of the infrastructure there. And I think as we go through this committee, one of our big issues is how do we help our state use the natural resources that we have so bountifully here in appropriate ways? We all love the place we live. We care about it. We want it to be there for our next generations to come. So some of the stuff you guys are doing is pretty impressive. And it's a little harder on the east side to grow trees than it is on the west side, but we see the potential for some of this on the west side as well. And we know there's at least one. So with that, Brett, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Senator Roblin.
Sure.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Brett Brownscombe with Governor Kitzhaber's office. I will try to speak briefly because folks have come from a long ways to deliver more substantive info on the status of collaboration or forest collaboratives in Oregon and the status of stewardship contracting in Oregon. So Pete will give the statewide overview of the forest collaboration issue, and then Kurt Quall and Mark Webb will talk about this from Kurt's Forest Service experience and perspective, Mark's county judge perspective, and their collective perspective in one part of the state where these issues are both playing out. And when you're in Grant County, it is Oregon, but there are other parts of Oregon. And this is, of course, relevant across the state. So what I wanted to just do to try to frame the issue was this is an issue that obviously the governor has expressed through his budget is keenly interested in, and both collaboration and the stewardship contracting pieces we regard as very critical to what you said, Senator, that the key issues around mill infrastructure, economic opportunity, community stability, and forest resilience, both in the forest product sector and the ecological piece of our federal forest lands, public's federal forest lands. So broad context, fire, it's getting bigger. Climate change is not helping with it. We're not prepared because we have hundreds of thousands, millions of acres in conditions that are not resilient to fire. It puts communities at risk, it puts assets at risk, and it puts ecosystems at risk. Mill infrastructure has already dwindled across the state. It's been pronounced on the east side, and what's left is critically tied to what happens on federal lands, which there's no need to harp on the level of frustration around management levels. Management levels are inadequate to support what is desired by a growing segment of, or I should say growing breadth of the public who are interested in forests, whether that be from an environmental standpoint, a forest product standpoint, or a community standpoint. So there are opportunities and challenges, and the opportunities are tied to both the stewardship contracting issue and the collaboration issue, I believe. And the increase in management that forest collaboratives have been able to demonstrate has been important. the diversity of jobs tied to a variety of projects that include timber supply and harvest. It also includes watershed jobs are important to the diversity of the workforce in rural communities. And there have been opportunities with the Forest Service indicating through the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program that it's willing to recognize Oregon's leadership and invest new money in the state. Those opportunities come with the challenges of the need to do more and the fact that where we are now isn't where we want to be. On the economic end, woody biomass is an opportunity, but I think there's a growing recognition across a lot of sectors that new opportunities on that front, the woody biomass front, as well as community health and the ecological desires tied to federal forests can't be achieved without a strong, viable local mill infrastructure. And that recognition, I think, has been a long time in coming. And I won't go on more because I want to turn it over. The governor has expressed in his budget a proposed investment of money tied to forest collaboratives, but also tied to a new business model approach with the Forest Service that gets at the use of stewardship contracting or other means to increase the pace and scale of work on the federal grounds. And collaboration and stewardship contracting are at the center of the governor's thinking. And I think with the panel here, hopefully we can provide a bit more insight as to why and what the opportunities and the challenges are.
Thank you.
Chair Roble, members of the committee, I'm Pete Dalk. I am an Oregon Solutions project staff to what's called the Federal Forest Advisory Committee Implementation Working Group. Oregon Solutions is housed at Portland State in the School of Government. We provide advice on collaborative governance and actually implement collaborative governance models. This Federal Forest Advisory Committee is something that came out of work that started in 2006, so that there was a report to the Board of Forestry in 2009 that went to our past governor regarding what needs, where there was agreement on moving forward with work on the federal ground. Some of that had to do with supporting collaboratives, as Brett mentioned, to move with the Forest Service to address landscape scale issues in our federal forest. I've provided written testimony to you. I won't follow that exactly. What I'd like to try to do in the next few minutes is just give you a sense of the scale and breadth of the collaboratives that we have across the state and some of the resources that might be available to you and some of the tools that the collaboratives are using. So first, in terms of the number of collaboratives, where they are, what they're doing, this began in the early 90s. There was an Applegate partnership that grew up in the Applegate Valley. That's probably the seed of where this effort is now, almost 20 years later. We've grown from that effort to what you would see on a map that should also be in your packet, color-coded map, where working with the University of Oregon Ecosystem Workforce Program, they have overlaid the federal ground with the collaboratives, and what this gives you is a notion of 23, we'll call it 23 today. These collaboratives are growing and they're changing very rapidly, but we've identified 23 in an inventory that we have completed as a part of work for the Federal Forest Advisory Committee work group and their information. There are collaboratives associated with all 11 national forests in the state and 7 of the 9 BLM districts in the state. The collaboratives don't have a firm basis in law. They're bottom-up organizations. Yet of the 23, we ask who was participating. We've identified well over 170 different organizations participating in these collaboratives. It's the counties. It's the federal partners themselves, those local government and federal partners at that level. It's the forest products industry participating, its conservation, environmental groups, and other interested citizens. It's a huge amount of social capacity that's going into these organizations, working on this issue, where can we find agreement to move forward with active management on the federal ground in hopes of returning forest health and maintaining social fabric in the local level as well as economic opportunity. We have an inventory that gives a lot of detailed information on each of these 23 collaboratives. I did not make you a copy of this. If you want one, I'd be glad to do it. It's also available online. It's about 94 pages long, but it does include a description of each of these collaboratives that we've been able to identify, who the contacts are. Some of them have websites. It gives some indication of what they've been working on, who their partners are, some of the outcomes that they've achieved, more of which you'll hear from the gentleman to my right in a moment. What I'd like to also let you know is these groups struggle for funding. There's no identified funding source for any of these. They apply for grants. They're all different levels of funding associated with them, different levels of staffing. Counties have participated in some funding. Forest Service has participated. Foundations have participated. Some of these organizations, just to give you a sense of their structure, are not identified as nonprofits. They don't have that status. They actually have to have a physical agent to help them get funding to provide staff so they can organize meetings, hold discussions, gather information, provide recommendations to the Forest Service. Having said that, there are a number of tools available to these groups, not just stewardship contracting. There's some information in your packet that refers to what's called collaboration by the law. It's in my testimony. Written testimony, the collaboration by the law, where the Forest Service saying there are places Congress directed us to pursue collaboration, that is stewardship contracting, the community forest landscape restoration, our collaborative forest landscape restoration program, Healthy Forest Restoration Act, working with the tribes, and a number of other areas where the Forest Service is engaging with these collaboratives at the direction of Congress. Wanted to give you some of those resources and let you know that there are other tools beyond just stewardship contracting, and spent a little bit of time gathering you information about the Collaborative Forest Landscape Scale Restoration Program that was passed by Congress. There is a material in your packet regarding that. We won't spend much time on that today, but basically this document gives you a sense of where that is in law. We have three projects in Oregon. There are 23 projects nationwide under that collaborative forest law that Congress passed in 2009. 23 projects nationwide, three are in Oregon. Now, there's one on the Deschutes, one on the Fremont-Wyneema Forest, and one that that Kurt and Mark helped get started on the Malheur Forest. Those require collaboration. Those require local groups working with the forest supervisor to advance a project through the Secretary of Interior's approval to receive funding to advance implementation of projects that they agree need to get done on the ground. There is a color-coded packet up there for you. It actually is a write-up of what was accomplished in each of those three projects in Oregon in 2012 and the amount of funding that came to those three projects. All said, there is a lot of activity. Oregon is really on the forefront, not only in the West, but across the country, of how collaboratives can advance forest health and forest restoration work. And recently, we worked at the direction of the legislature and Governor Kitzhaber to help deliver a study on national forest health, restoration, and the economic impacts. There's a four-page summary of that study that was released in December at the Oregon Business Leadership Summit. You'll hear more about that later this afternoon as it ties to Senate Bill 257. That link is also in my testimony to the full report, which again is a fairly lengthy report, but does get into some metrics of what's happening. And this is focused on the east side fire-prone forest. It doesn't get into the forests that are more moist, west side, higher productivity, but more the east side forest. What level of activity is there and what would happen if you accelerated that, and some ideas on how you might accelerate that with state and federal partnership. I'll leave it at that. I know that's sort of a quick overview of collaboratives, 20-year history in Oregon, building off a lot of other collaborative efforts that we've seen in the state, and tools that are coming from the federal government that they can utilize to address this issue of more jobs, more work, better forest health, addressing some of the fire issues that we have around the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Senator Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Kurt Quall, recently retired Forest Service after 34 years, hung it up, and on the Malheur National Forest in John Day, Oregon. And what I'd like to share with you today is how stewardship contracting works and how that's important to our collaborative partners, how it's important to our communities, the economics in the communities, and also the economics of doing restoration on the landscape. I provided a handout for you that is titled Stewardship Contracting Overview. And essentially in 2003, Congress provided the Forest Service with a list of authorities in which we could more efficiently accomplish restoration. And you'll ask, well, why did they need to do that? And I'll contrast that for you here later on. Some of those authorities was the authority for trade goods for services, and essentially to take the value of the material that we sold and trade that for getting service work done on the landscape, other restoration projects. Also to be able to use those stewardship receipts that we derive from the sale of the timber to complete those restoration activities, to award task orders and contracts to multiple contractors in one contract document, to use best value, not having to rely on the low bidder for award of a contract, but look at a contractor's past performance, look at his technical proposal and how he was going to accomplish the work and how that was going to best meet the outcomes that we desired on the landscape. And also to use benefit to local community criteria, which allows the agency to provide a criteria in the evaluation of a contract proposal that gives more benefit, more weighting to that proposal because of the local attributes that a local contractor or purchaser would bring versus somebody from outside of the community. So what are the differences? Why was stewardship contracting and those new authorizations given to us? And if you looked at the tool that we used previous to that, it was a timber sale. And if you break down how a timber sale worked and where that funding went from the dollars that we made from selling timber, it's easy to see why stewardship contracting was needed. So when we sold timber, every dollar that we received, 25 cents went to the Treasury, 25 cents went to the counties where the timber was harvested, a nickel came off the top for national overhead to provide funding for leases, computers, utilities, and such not with the agency, and the remaining 45 cents went into several different agency accounts. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time. It was a brush disposal account, an account called Knutson Vandenberg KV, and the salvage sale fund. And the long and the short of it is when the agency asked for that funding back from those accounts, we essentially were, again, had money taken off the top for overhead. And it resulted in that, on the average, we would get about 20 cents off of every dollar that we earned from the sale of timber on National Forest System lands. And the funding that we did receive was very limited in where we could use it and what we could use it for. And we were not able to accomplish the wide array of restoration activities that the landscape was demanding and that was needed. Some of the other attributes of a timber sale is you could only award a timber sale to one purchaser, and you couldn't add additional funds to a timber sale in order to get other restoration activities done. You were real limited on that. And like I said earlier, the collected funds were very limited in use. How stewardship contracting contrasts in that is that there's a variety of stewardship tools and types. And probably foundational and key, most importantly, and the gentlemen to my left have spoken about that, is one of the precursors of being able to use stewardship contracting is there has to be collaboration with diverse stakeholders on the project. And that is a qualification for using stewardship contracting or agreements. Another important fact to notice is that for every dollar that is earned in a stewardship contract or agreement, That dollar stays on the unit, the forest where it was earned, and can go to getting other restoration activities accomplished. What kinds of restoration activities are we talking about? That's a pretty vague term, and it really covers just about every kind of management activity type that you can think of on a national forest system land. It could be aspen restoration, stream restoration, hazardous fields reduction like hand piling, thinning, grapple piling, prescribed fire, wildlife and fisheries restoration, culvert replacement, just about anything that the Forest Service does as far as the restoration activity on public lands. So what are the different types? One of the first types I want to talk to you about is similar to a timber sale contract. It's called an IRTC, or an Integrated Resource Timber Contract. And that stewardship type is used when the value of the timber is equal to or greater than what it costs to have it removed and hauled to a mill. And the receipts that are generated from that value of that material can then be used to accomplish other restoration activities on that particular project, or they can be transferred to another stewardship project on that forest. An IRSC, or an Integrated Resource Service Contract, that's where the value of the timber won't pay its way out of the woods. The value is not there to get all the timber, the biomass, off the landscape and to the mills. We have to add additional funds to that, appropriated dollars or secure rural schools funding, grant money, or whatever it needs in order to subsidize having that material removed, as well as subsidizing getting the rest of the restoration activities done on that project. And then we have a stewardship agreement, and that's a joint endeavor between two parties that have a mutual interest in seeing restoration done on the landscape. And it could be local, state government, tribes, nonprofits. And typically, there's not competition on a stewardship agreement. It's an agreement between the agency and that entity. And you can use either an IRTC or an IRSC in that agreement. I went over that kind of fast. I hope that was clear. There probably have some questions. But I want to share with you why that's important to the Malheur National Forest and the two collaborative groups that are there and to those communities and the economics there. Earlier you heard mention of the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act and the proposal. We have a proposal that covers 700,000 acres, and we're going to be going over those 700,000 acres on the Malheur National Forest with the partners over the next 7 years through 2019. In the proposal that was jointly written with the partners, we have to come up, we receive, or I should say the Malheur National Forest receives $2.5 million from Congress. The forest has to come up with $2.5 million a match. And one of the things they allow the Forest Service to use for match is stewardship receipts. So about two-thirds of the proposal with the partners on the Malheur National Forest is using stewardship receipts. Over the last 3.5 years, we've used an IRSC type contract with the partners to get restoration work done on the Malheur National Forest. Within that contract is a pool of six local contractors. Those six local contractors represent about 80 employees between Grant and Harney County. That's huge for Grant County and for Harney County. Big workforce. And the products that come off of those task orders, that stewardship contract, are sold to over eight industries in Eastern Oregon. Most of the industries, all the mills except for one, and they just chose not to participate in that contract. Currently, the Malheur National Forest has approximately $2 million in stewardship receipts. And though that $2 million of receipts is spent annually, it is rotated through the stewardship program. And then as the materials are sold to the mills, that money comes back to the forest. And again, the next year it's used. And like I said earlier, that's used as a significant part of our match in the CFLR program. Over the past 7 years, the forest, the Mount Hair National Forest, has been producing about 25 to 30 million board feet annually. Recently, Mount Hair Lumber, the last remaining operating industry in Grant County, was about to close down. In response to that, the Mount Hair Forest and the partners are doing something that is unheard of in the U.S. forest system. Over the next 2 years, they're going to double the amount of volume that is going to come off of the Mount Hair National Forest, up to $60 million. 3 years, we're going to triple it, and it's going to be 70 million
board feet,
From 30 million board feet, the next 2 years, 60 million board feet. In 2015, it'll be 75 million board feet. That's unheard of within an agency to double and then to triple their program in that short of time. The Mount Hair National Forest would not be able to do that without the support of the two collaborative groups that they have that are helping them to get the planning necessary to do the implementation on those acres and reduce that amount of board feet. So we're going to have to change a little bit the way they're doing business. So the Mount Hair is putting together a 10-year stewardship contract and has already held public meetings with industry, with local government, and interested community members, and they are beginning to format how that contract will look, and they expect to have it awarded by August of 2013. And it's going to be weighted heavily towards benefit to local community, probably along the lines where the saw logs and the biomass will be manufactured in Grant County and heavier weighting to using local contractors to get that work done. So I just want to close with this, that talked about stewardship contracting, an important tool, and the bottom line is that without collaboration and the help that we've had from our partners over the last 7 years, there wouldn't be stewardship contracting. The Mount Hair National Forest wouldn't have $2 million of receipts to spend this year on restoration activities. There would be no industries left in Grant and Harney County. And I can say without a single doubt that John Day and the associated communities there in that county would pretty much be ghost towns. And the National Forest there would pretty much be an office of firefighters and not a bunch of people working to get restoration done in the landscape. Without the partners, we wouldn't be able to look at increasing the pace of restoration that we're undertaking. Essentially, we're going to be going from treating 15,000 acres a year to 30,000. And that's going to require an accomplishment of 60,000 acres of planting annually in order to be able to get that much restoration done. It's pretty significant. And thanks to collaboration, over the last 7 years, we haven't had any lawsuits or appeals. We have been moving forward unimpeded because people have decided to sit down at the table and work together. And because of the robust stewardship program that we have, our communities are beginning to prosper again. We've been able to keep our contractors. We've been able to keep at least one mill running. Possibility that another mill could open with this accelerated program and expansion of the stewardship program. And it's been very significant and important to all of us. So I thank you.
Thank you.
So
we'll wait for all of them to do questions. So, yes. Please.
So I'm Mark Webb, former Grant County judge. And first off, I really do want to thank you all for being able to speak with you. I just can't emphasize too much what a significant opportunity there is associated with collaborative and the collaborative effort on federal land management, as well as stewardship contracting. We are at a watershed moment, I think, for moving forward in federal land management. So I'm just going to share a bit of Grant County history, which really is, as y'all know, the history for lots of resource-dependent counties, timber-dependent counties. In Grant County, when I came into office in 2007, status quo was no activity was occurring. The legal and legislative framework associated with our environmental laws, federal land management, makes it extremely easy to shut down any activity whatsoever, good or bad. And that is what had happened. And as a result, as y'all will know from other communities, our communities were suffering. They were compromised. Unemployment was going up. Poverty was going up. The cost for public health services was increasing. The vitality of the communities was suffering significantly, as well as the forest environment around it. It was going downhill. Motivation for the collaborative, a number of people began to appreciate that the status quo simply was unacceptable and unworkable, and we had to do something different. And I think what made it work for Grant County, and I think for the drier side, east side counties generally, is that industry was desperate for logs, but they were willing to live with smaller logs than what they were used to in the past. Perhaps more critical is the environmental community, who had been so successful in shutting down activity on forest lands, began to appreciate that they were losing the very thing that they were fighting for, the old growth structure. They were losing it to wildfires that were unnatural because the lands were no longer managed. So those two parties figured that they had no option but to try something different, and the collaborative effort is that option. Tried something different. The point of the collaborative is to nip the legal and legislative challenges in the bud early on, to have these conversations about what we think we can't live with, what we're not going to live with, or what we think we'll live with early on in the planning process, so that they're not stopped at the end, adding additional time, cost, and probably no activity at all. Yeah, so the movement, this is what is significant for me and exciting for our county. The scale has increased, and there are, I think, Kurt mentioned that there's been no litigation for 5, 6, 7 years. That's true. Some people will say, both in the industry and outside the industry associated with environmental communities, was because the projects weren't controversial. Well, in a sense, that's true, but that you could get industry folk and environmentalists together to do any kind of activity on federal lands is very significant. And so our first project was maybe 6,000 acres, and it took us 2 hard years to get there. We are now pushing 42,000 acre projects. So the size has increased. The pace has increased. Before the collaborative came into existence and was working with the Forest Service, you were looking at least 3 years or more to get a project planned on a small scale, maybe 6,000 acres to 10,000. We're now getting big projects planned in 2 years or less. So we've increased the speed at which they're occurring by a third. You're cutting the cost, which means you can do more work on the ground. That's a direct result of the collaborative effort. Also equally significant, part of the issue is that collaboratives and stewardship contracting are appropriately restoration oriented. But we've made the case that you're not going to do restoration long-term sustainably unless there's a strong economic component to it. We've done that. And one example is, whereas originally in stewardship contracting, we were maybe treating 15% of the landscape or the project. So if we had a 10,000 acre project, we might actually treat 15,000 acres and take some commercial products off. Anymore, we're pushing 50%. That's how we get the volume up and still target the kind of ecological resilience on the ground we want for healthy forests that satisfy the environmentalist and that promise to give us something sustainably down the road in 20, 30, 40 years so that we can still be in the timber industry. So those are some of the other changes we've made. And one other is the complexity of the prescriptions. And I can't go into that too much except to say that at least Eastside, until probably a year ago, there wasn't a timber sale or a stewardship contract that went forward if you were considering cutting something over 21 inches. We're doing that now. We're doing it for good, sound ecological reasons. So those are the kind of conversations we've had. And I think both industry and environmentalists and the other local citizens involved have matured in a way that we're having these kind of conversations that are solution-oriented. And so I am glossing over challenges. It's not easy. This is about developing healthy relationships, and relationships are hard to build with people you disagree deeply with, but we're doing it. At any rate, I think there's 3 main things to think about in terms of the collaborative effort. It is solution-oriented in a way that we've never seen other federal land management activities in the past. I think, to my mind, what I like to say is that it matures the public process. As long as we have federal land management, we're going to have NEPA, and we're going to have the public involved in what's going on in federal land, and that's appropriate. The difficulty comes is that these public lands are in local context, and oftentimes the public doesn't appreciate fully what stopping activity does for the communities that depend on them, as well as for the ground that depends on the activity. And the collaborative gives local input a significance it never had, and it gives locals an ownership we never had in the past. And by local, I'm being fairly inclusive. It doesn't mean just if you live in Grant County. It means if you're a part of the collaborative, committed to having solutions that address both landscape needs and community needs. And that includes environmentalists from Central Oregon and Western Oregon and so on. So by local, it is an inclusive sort of local. But it is locally based. It's from the ground up kind of effort. I just can't stress it. I think in today's age, today's world, with today's challenges, collaborative efforts are the best way forward. If we're serious about economic development, we're serious about healthy rural communities, and we're serious about healthy forests that are sustainable over the decades, this is the way to go. It's been our experience. Finally, I would just add that I think stewardship contracts, which are distinct from collaboratives, I mean, Kurt talked about the fact that a stewardship contract requires collaboration. Collaboratives can do their work in many different ways, but stewardship contracting is an important tool of collaboratives because it meets both the environmentalist needs and concerns about doing restoration work or ecologically appropriate work on the ground, as well as the industry's needs to get commercial products off. And stewardship contracts are very effective at that. They're a sort of a broad-based landscape approach that meets this variety of needs. What I like about it as an elected official was that it diversifies our economy. We're not just dependent on a sawmill getting saw log volume to the mill, where depending on the market or something that can go up or down, you're diversifying your economy without bringing, as the state has tried to do in the past, things that really didn't fit rural Oregon. You're diversifying your economy by creating value for the same sort of thing you've been dealing with a long time. And then last of all, it really does lower federal costs because you keep the money local. When federal dollars from timber receipts go to D.C., come back to the regional office and come here, you talk about a skimming. It's been done. And this really does protect investment. You get more bang for your dollar by keeping it local. And, I'll maybe speak to this in the next session, but we've become so successful on the Mount here that we are proposing projects that outstrip the Forest Service's ability to fund them. And what we've proposed is to use road dollars as an investment to do that, both to maintain the forest, to enhance the forest, to stimulate the economy, and to generate an alternative source of revenue from secure rural schools or others, which are pretty iffy. So that's the kind of commitment the county has wanted to make to sort of motivate this, and it's only because the collaborative has been successful that we can do that, and it's likely only because we have something like stewardship contracting that we would be able to implement that. So I'll just stop with that.
So questions for this group?
Sure.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Well, this is really good news, what you're able to accomplish over there. I just had a couple questions. You're dealing with mainly pine over there, right?
Right.
Is it lodgepole and ponderosa?
Well, it's ponderosa and lodgepole.
Mm-hmm. And what logging techniques are you using in the logging? You don't clear cut those, right?
No, they don't anymore. They did for a while and attempted to introduce white fir as a species. But it's usually tractor ground, most of it is. There's some mm-hmm. still high lead logging. Prices aren't high enough that you could log the really steep stuff with helicopter logging. Mm-hmm. But it is predominantly pine. I would say, though, that as a result of these conversations, say even 3 years ago, the environmental community wouldn't talk about activity in cool, moist forest, which is more what you would find west side. And in the northeastern part of eastern Oregon, we're having those conversations now. That doesn't mean they'll go anywhere, but we've developed that kind of relationship and trust that we can at least begin to talk about it.
Okay, and just another question. One of the very frustrating things to me, just watching this kind of from a distance, is the inability to get in there and do salvage logging. Is this solve that problem, these collaboratives?
It's interesting you say that. It's probably one of the more contentious issues. One of the areas that's most contentious to the environmental community because science says that there is absolutely no ecological benefit from doing salvage after fire. From a community perspective and an economic perspective, to leave it all stand out there is not acceptable. The Blue Mountain Partner, Forest Partners has been very successful on collaborating on two fire salvage projects. No, we didn't go out and we salvaged the whole area and get every tree out that was available that was burnt and dead. But we did make inroads, and we are continuing to have conversations with the collaborative group and make inroads on that area, more so than probably anybody else nationally. So we're making progress. We had a fire in on the mount here this year, 6,000 acres, parish cabin fire. Collaborative group went out and were able to find consent on that project to do hazardous tree removal along all the roads 200 feet in. Resulted in about 3.5 million board feet that's going to help keep Malheur Lumber open the rest of this winter. So it was a start.
Great. And just one more, yeah, if I could. The other issue was thinning, especially with the pines, with the ponderosa pines. I know in Deschutes County that's been a real big issue. Is that dealt with in your stewardship?
That is a part of the stewardship contracting. And what we're doing, and it's not the same across Eastern Oregon in terms of, or the state in terms of the targets, but what we've tried to do is target ecological resilience. What makes this a resilient landscape? Mm-hmm. And once you have that, it's pretty hard for the environmentalists to argue with, well, that means cutting this size tree at this amount. And it also has sort of natural limits on what you can harvest. But we are having those conversations, and we're trying to develop a framework where they sort of fall out of naturally what the land needs, and trying to accommodate the community infrastructure to meet those needs. And that's how we're targeting sustainability.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like you've done an amazing job of getting people who are not necessarily of like mind together for a common
Well, we have solution. Here. Again, I wouldn't want to gloss over that it is very difficult. It may not work the same everywhere. But I can guarantee you that the old way of doing things is a non-starter anymore. You're not going anywhere, and you just as well close up shop.
It was a real emotional roller coaster when we started out. There was days it just absolutely looked like it was not going to work.
And sounds like the legislature.
And we had folks from the environmental community that successfully, their organizations that successfully sued us for 20 years. And brought us to the state of polarization. Those people are now best friends. After meetings, you know, go to the bar and have a drink with them, and they are very sincere about helping to restore our forests and to see them become resilient.
Bringing them back, though.
So,
yeah. Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, gentlemen, my husband has been in the forest products industry for 40 years. Second generation timber, works in the timber industry, or what's left of it, as he says. You guys are all government people, and it's been people from government who have destroyed the number one industry of Oregon for the past 30 years. So while I'm encouraged with what you're doing, our communities have been devastated. I'll just give you an example from Albany. We had our paper mill exploded last year to the ground. Those were $72,000 a year jobs. And the community of Millersburg lost $800,000 in yearly revenues. That was a paper mill that had won awards for environmentalism, their environmental achievements, from EPA. So our communities are devastated, and it's going to take a long time to get them back. I'm wondering about your collaboratives, because I don't see a lot of industry input here. Maybe it's hidden in there. I see Ochoco, but it is the companies that hire the workers, train them, train the graders, ship the product out of our ports where they pay fees, go overseas, find the markets. This is what my husband does. And it's very, very difficult. Most of our mills are gone, the vast majority. Willamette Industries went out. Russia came over and bought mills and took them down and took them to Russia and put them up there. Now we've lost markets to Russia. You go to Japan, and it's Russian wood that's on the dock. So I'm glad everybody's having a drink together, but do you understand that is way late? It's way late.
Could I speak to that?
Yeah, Mark.
So first off, I am have been an elected official 2007 through early January this year. So like you, an elected official, a government employee. Before that, I was a contractor, worked most of my life in the woods. Secondly, I can't emphasize enough that on the one hand, not every mill owner or industry person is on board with this. But I also can't emphasize enough that in Eastern Oregon, industry is on board. You have Boise Cascade taking a serious role in collaborative efforts. You have Ochocoa Malheur Lumber taking a lead role. Johnson Mills, they've been perhaps maybe less supportive, but they've been at the table. They've been involved with the collaborative. They're a beneficiary of these conversations. The main industry folk in our community, not the mill owners, but the loggers, those who do the hand piles, the thinning, all the associated things that used to go with a logging and timber sale are very supportive of this. So you're exactly right that these are desperate times. Not everybody's on board. Most of the people are on board. It is making a significant difference for our community in terms of whether they're going to be able to cut trees in 5 years and 10 years. More work needs to be done. So just, I mean, I don't want to, again, belittle or, yeah, so.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to commend the work of the collaborative. I mean, to me, from over here on the west side, what we, I think, the closest comparison are the watersheds and how you basically brought people together that had completely polar differences, that they're all sitting together and actually working and actually bettering those watersheds. And I understand Senator Close's concerns and frustrations. I hear it in my district as well, but the reality, I think it was said very well, the old way doesn't work, and people getting locked out of being able to do their livelihood has been on the line for some time, and we have not seen the federal government being able to accomplish what many people would want, whatever that is, on either side. And here we're actually got locals that are actually working together and bringing something forward, and it may not be quite as quick and fast as we may want it to be, but it's actually planning for the future, and hopefully it will continue to build those relationships to the point of where you can actually get more jobs back online and actually take care of getting sustainable board feet out. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Senator Bercher.
Is it Kurt Quayle?
Quall.
Back to your old timber sale days, you forgot slash deposit and road use fees.
That's brush disposal.
Oh, okay. I've paid enough in my lifetime, I'll never forget them. So, yeah, you know, I'm actually involved in a couple of stewardship contracts on the west side, and I applaud for what you've gotten done because we haven't got that done on the west side. We're still struggling, and the biggest problem is the prescriptions are so that we're literally not shipping any commodities out. We're just basically doing fuel reduction, and that just costs the taxpayer. It's definitely not a revenue-neutral project. So I'd like to have a lengthy conversation with you at some point to see what you have done, because we're just literally, you know, pulling our hair out and trying to get some of this done.
Well, thank you, Senator, and I'd love to have that conversation with you, too. The biggest thing I can point to, again, is the collaborative. Prior to the collaborative groups, we were removing about 2,500 board feet to the acre. Don't even compare that with West Side. I mean, we have to
right.
cover a lot
so.
More.
We know that. We know that.
What was the number again?
2,500 board feet on the average.
Per acre.
Yes.
Well, you're doing better than we are.
Well, that was pre-collaboration. Because of the aggressive prescriptions that the collaborators have agreed on, we're now removing 3,500 board feet on the average. And when you talk about economics on whether you're going to be able to remove timber from a unit on a ground, 1,000 board feet per acre can make or break the difference of being able to treat that unit, plus the receipts that come from that to go to get the other restoration activities done. And so it was the collaboration that did that. We would have been in the old three-year syndrome and looking at an appeal and a lawsuit at the end of the 3 years. So.
Well, yeah, I would like to have that conversation, you know, at some point with you, because we struggle with that. And, you know, I'm a very firm believer in the stewardship programs. I think they're it's a fabulous idea. It's just that, you know, we have 2 10-year contracts. We're into year 5, and you know, when the Title III monies run out and stuff like that, we're all finished. Yeah. And it doesn't need to be that way.
No.
It can be revenue neutral.
Yes, it could be.
Yeah. Thank you.
And that's what we attained, actually.
And I just want to say, and Kurt, is your background degree in forestry, or Where are you at?
I went to the School of Hard Knocks University.
Oh, very good for you.
But I have worked in about every discipline in the force of us. So.
Having lived my whole life either in the Olympic Peninsula or on the Oregon coast, where there's a lot of logging and stuff that has gone on, and a lot of family that have been in logging for about 100 years on the coast, the thing that has frustrated me the most in talking to some good friends in the Forest Service and the BLM is they have amazing experience, knowledge, and they know how to do what they have not been able to do. And, you know, I watched your expression about what you've gotten done, and it's kind of like you finally got to do what you spent your whole life to do here at the end of your career. And I'm pleased with that because, I mean, so often we don't recognize the expertise, the knowledge, and of the federal workers that are out there doing, wanting to do the job, and they know what they need to do to make the place resilient. They know what they need to do to harvest that and keep those communities alive. But because of the way we've been fighting in the last, they haven't been able to do their job. And I'm thankful that someone at the federal level at least got one program that could start working, and then that people like our judge over in the county decided to take advantage and do that. Because the frustration that we heard here is the frustration that just about everybody has in Oregon. Mm-hmm. When you consider the valuable landscape we have and how valuable it can be for everybody, and still retain all those values that we want for recreation and all the other kinds of benefits that come from our forest. And you can do all of it. I mean, that's the thing that's, and especially on the west side, you could do all of it because it grows so well over here. And you guys have done it on the worst, the hardest part. Yeah. And that's gives me hope that we can start developing these kinds of relationships on this side. And I think it's going to happen more in your area down south because that's where it got started. So my hope is there. We just need to keep it pushing.
Could I make two quick points? One is that I think it's worth appreciating that the collaborative started out focusing on projects on the ground. And what we found out is that in order for those to be successful, we've essentially run back up the line and you have to restructure the Forest Service as well and how it does things. And that's happening. And that ties to the last point I want to make. In the same way that at least a local collaborative had significant impact in Grant County and some of the other Eastern Oregon counties, by doing things differently, by working with the feds in a new and novel way, I really do think the state can follow that lead and start to do business differently with the feds. You don't have to worry about who owns it as long as it's being managed in the appropriate way. And there's real opportunity here for the state to take a lead in that regard.
That is such a perfect segue to our next hearing. So any other questions? Hearing none, we'll close our public hearing on our Federal Forest Collaboratives. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 257. And Brett will leave you up there, and you can give a short explanation. And we have some other people who want to talk as well.
So Senate Bill 257 establishes a forest product sale loan fund to provide loans to the U.S. Forest Service to prepare for and conduct forest product sales from federal forest lands within Oregon. It would continuously appropriate the money into the fund to the State Board of Forestry to carry out the loan program. It would also require loan repayments and interest to be deposited in the fund. The bill would also authorize the issuance of lottery bonds and allocate the net proceeds to the fund.
So should we have Mark and Amanda come on up as well, or do you want to just start this?
Chair Roblin, your pleasure,
okay.
I think.
Well, since there are three that have signed up, come on up and again. And with that, I'll let Brett start.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, so Senate Bill 257, as we understand this, the concept here is aimed at getting at an issue that relates to the federal forest animal is a large animal with a lot of
right.
pieces. And as Senator Close's remarks during the last hearing, I think evidence, there is a huge amount of urgency around doing something to reverse current conditions on the federal forest ground. And those, there are a variety of ways to carve up skin, whatever you want to do to the animal,
yep.
to address this issue. This bill is aimed at one particular approach, and there are others certainly related to reducing costs tied to planning and other efficiencies and implementation where you can
improve the ability of the Forest Service to move money into work on the ground tied to getting management done and product out. And what this bill proposes to do is to look at the funding issue, recognize that the status quo, and this is also pointed out in the economic assessment that that has been done on this issue, that the National Forest Restoration Economic Assessment for Oregon. If we stick with the status quo, that assessment identifies the economic benefits that will be produced. It also identifies the benefits that could be gained by through increasing the level of management, doubling the level of management across the state, in that case, the dry side of the state. But it's clear that if on the federal ground in Oregon, management pace and scale were able to reach higher, the economic benefits, the social benefits to communities are very clear, as are the habitat benefits. This bottleneck that this bill proposes to address is the fact that there are a limited number of dollars that are coming from Congress to get work done on the federal ground. As stated earlier, there are ways to squeeze more out of those dollars, but they're likely going to be less in the end than what is desired in terms of outcomes and outputs from the federal ground. So this loan fund would be seeded with lottery bonds to allow the state to loan funds to the agency specified to be put into projects that get product off the ground. There's a clear recognition in this bill that the production of that of timber products from investments of these dollars is directly tied to jobs, tied to doing that work, which in turn is tied to the health of rural communities. That's the public interest argument in this. What I wanted to point out from the governor's office end is we're interested in this bill and continuing to look at addressing the language here so that we can get around one particular bottleneck on the federal end to the opposite end of the loan fund concept, the repayment concept, because right now at the federal level, the Forest Service, even if it receives money from a willing entity, whether it be a county, the state, or another entity, cannot pay that back, which, aside from the reasonableness of that policy, it is the way it is at the federal level. And so what we're interested in looking to do in working with bill proponents on this and supporters is to adjust the language in this bill to allow other means for the money to be paid back to the state. It may not be, there may be other ways than just the Forest Service paying the money back that the repayment side of this loan fund concept could be accomplished. But again, the overall idea of adding to the state's ability to put money behind its desire to see more happen on the ground and use that money to, with strings attached, require the outcomes and the outputs on a product end that the state desires. That's the motivation behind this bill, and with that motivation, our office is supportive.
And that's why it's a public hearing today, because we need to figure out what those issues are so we can start having the ability to address them as time goes on, and earlier the better for the session. So, and for the record, could you identify yourself again on this particular one?
My apologies, Chair Roble, members of the committee, Brett Brownscomb with Governor Kitzhaber's office. And both previous hearing and this hearing, thank you all for the opportunity to testify. These are all very important issues for rural communities and the state as a whole.
Thank you.
Sure.
Should I want to go first? Okay. So, again, microphone. Mark Webb, former Grant County Judge. And, again, I do thank you for the opportunity to share. Now, I think this is, again, a critical opportunity the state should take advantage of. And I'm just going to provide a little background because I'm in Grant County, we sort of initiated this conversation. So, as you know, Secure Rural Schools has been, at least in my tenure, 2 1-year reauthorizations and 1 4-year.
Every time it's dead, it really is a limited tenure, it's or limited duration. It's not going to continue. And I've had conversations with our congressional delegation on several occasions about how can we invest these SRS dollars differently so that we're able to transition the way that both the feds and the state expect resource-dependent counties do. Because as the bill is written up, we can only spend it where we've always spent it. In Eastern Oregon, that's on our roads and our schools. We have no ability to do anything different. So that's part of the context. Secondly, I just mentioned that, at least with our collaborative and others are promising to push these limits, we've already got projects on the ground that are exceeding the Forest Service's ability to fund them. All right? So whether they don't prioritize, the feds don't prioritize it, or they don't have the money, it doesn't matter. Is there a different revenue source so that we can get these projects on the ground? That's what we've tried to think about. And we've talked about with the feds, both the congressional delegation and with the Forest Service, using road fund dollars to underwrite the cost of these projects with two caveats. One is that it is an investment. So we expect that principal to be protected, and we expect some rate of return because we still need to run the road department. But the idea is to make available money to the Forest Service they otherwise wouldn't have to do work they otherwise couldn't that is critical both for them, for the environment, and for the communities. And that's what we've tried to do and suggest. And I think this takes off of that in nice ways. And I actually think that the state's in a better position to move forward with this than we are. There are some challenges at the congressional level in terms of paying that investment back. In addition, we don't have any other way to go about it because our general fund is property tax revenue. All right. The state has a broader array of revenue sources, income tax and other things that an economy that was clipping along would benefit the state in a way that it doesn't benefit county government. And so I just think that you're in a good opportunity there to move forward with that. The only other thing I would say, and I haven't heard it from you all, but I have heard it from other individuals, both non-elected and elected officials, is this. It really is the Fed's responsibility to fund federal land management. Well, yes, it is their responsibility, but they're not doing it. And maybe they can't or whatever, but let's not lose sight of the fact that there's significant opportunity here to invest in a way that's going to make a significant difference to the environment. It's going to make a significant difference to rural communities, and it's going to make a significant difference to the state as a whole if you can get the right bill passed and get in the right working relationship with the feds on this. Again, it is a novel approach. It really does open up significantly new opportunities for doing things differently that are going to benefit a whole lot of people. So that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Amanda Rich. I'm the Director of State Government Relations for the Oregon Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. And I also want to thank you for paying giving time and attention to this critically important issue. Nationally and here in Oregon, the Nature Conservancy has made increased active management and restoration of America's forests a key priority. And specifically here in Oregon, we're focused on those dry, fire-prone forests of eastern Oregon that you've heard talked about earlier. And you know, there's not much to be said. The gentlemen that have come before me have done a superb job of laying out the case and one possible solution, one avenue for you here. But I think what I would like to stress, as others have stressed, is the urgency. Economically, ecologically, and socially, we are at a critical tipping point. We've got 5 million acres, at least our scientists tell us, we've got 5 million acres of fire-prone forests in Oregon that are at risk of large, uncharacteristic wildfire, and we are facing rapidly escalating costs for fighting those fires. Those forests are desperately in need of active management. You've heard about the mill closures and the critical infrastructure that we're going to lose that is going to make it impossible, economically impossible, to solve this problem if we don't act now. And I can't say enough about the double-digit employment and the rising levels of poverty that we're seeing in our rural communities and the fabric of the communities that's, that is being lost. So we got a choice. We've got a choice. We can view this situation as a paralyzing crisis, or we can view it as an enormous opportunity to take advantage of standing wealth. And in terms of this specific bill, I think that Brett has done a very good job of laying out for you. We share the same opinion about what needs to be done to make the bill workable, and we just really hope that you'll give us a chance to work on this bill and with you, and to move this bill. It's a tool in the toolbox. Right. There's no silver bullet, but it's a tool, and we're working very actively to along other lines as well to find some other tools, and we very much appreciate your partnership in that effort. Thank you.
Question? Yes, Brett.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm kind of saddened that we're even talking about lending the feds to lay out sales on their own ground. I really am kind of saddened. With that being said, though, the question I have is the federal government does not have the mechanism to repay these loans. Should maybe we be changing the terminology to grants?
Chair Roblin, Senator Bartshager, that change in term would assume that there would be no repayment other than the economic benefits from the timber sale or the project that produces whatever output can produce. That conversation obviously is a big policy question that with this bill comes before the legislature. From my end, I've heard, I can tell you, a variety of opinions from a variety of different interests on this. One thought that is in the governor's mind on this is the status quo isn't working. We're looking for creative ways to get things off the dime and move in a way that can increase the pace and scale of work on the federal ground, including timber outputs. If the state does anything to increase the pressure on creating a more logical federal policy or avenues that changes in federal policy could move into based on initial opportunities advanced by the state, that could create a positive dynamic, whether it's done through a grant, a loan, or other tools such as the governor and his budget has identified an approach also backed by lottery bonds that would invest in a new business model type approach tied to critical mill infrastructure on the dry side of the state. There are a lot of different tools out there. I would be very wary about committing to a grant approach if there's no means of ensuring that that money is going to be repaid to the public's treasury.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably nobody in this room that would rather see commodities leaving the forest than me, okay? But, a loan that's not going to be repaid maybe needs to have a different name. I don't know. Like I said, I'm deeply disturbed that we're even having to even have this conversation. But if the state needs to intervene to help the Forest Service lay out some sales to get forest commodities on the road, I'm willing to have that conversation, but I want to know, what are we talking about? Are we talking about loans? Are we talking about grant? I mean, if they can't pay us back, that's not a loan to me.
Chair Roblin, Senator Bartshager, I think that's right. In the context, what I wanted to point out is there are a lot of folks that I've heard from who said, well, if you do this, if you invest money, even if you call it a grant or call it something other than a loan, just recognize the fact that if you invested in timber sales, it's going to result in product coming off the ground that creates jobs. So there's that public benefit, product that is a traded commodity. So there's that economic benefit. Whether it's done as a timber sale, receipts into the counties, or if the money is plowed back into other projects through stewardship contracting, you start to create a revolving fund that is tied to jobs on the ground and product off the ground. So I don't think the idea is without merit, but it's obviously a big novel move for a state to be considering. And I know in the governor's budget, with what we're proposing to do with lottery-backed bonds on the east side federal grounds, we are making that investment based on the expectation that the jobs, product, and saved cost from not having to do as much on large catastrophic wildfire fighting or investments in the social infrastructure of communities are going to be worth the while.
Yes.
And so how much are we talking about? I mean, I don't, just kind of give me a ballpark.
And it should be either one of you.
Well, I just know for Grant County that if we had another $3 to $4 million annually, that we would be increasing the scale of work to an amount that we need. That would keep
$3 to $4 million board feet.
No,
$3 to $4 million.
How many board feet would that, or how much would that generate? Not that we're going to get it paid back.
Well, Kurt could speak to that more, but we're talking probably the 75 million board feet.
Okay.
And with the Forest Service, their board feet is a little bit different than a sawmill's board feet, so it's not all merchantable timber. I can say that the Forest Service, of course, they can't make the kind of commitments, but as you said, the security is standing on the ground, and they appreciate that. What they don't have the means to do is to increase the pace, and that's what we're looking at, and that's why we were thinking and the state's thinking about how can we help bootstrap this up in a way. And again, for us, we would have to have the principal protected in some rate of return because we only get property taxes for general revenue. But for the state, your opportunities are open up, and I think this is what Brett was talking about. Let's just suppose the state invests a dollar. They don't pay you back anything, but in fact, it generates another $5 worth of revenue off of that to the state in various ways. If you have good economic arguments that show that, you can go forward. Just know that it's not a traditional model, but you're getting your money's worth, and I think that's part of what the bill's trying to wrestle with. And I don't want to speak for Brett or the governor's office, but part of the trouble we've had in talking with the congressional delegation is we don't know what word to put on it yet, loan, investment, a grant, or whatever. We just know how we want it to function. And that's what we're trying to work with them through. And it is such a novel idea, especially back in D.C. and with the Congressional Budget Office, that really somebody that knows what's going on needs to spend time back there. I'm pretty confident we can find the right mechanisms, the right terminology to do what we want, call it what we want. But I think that's what the bill's trying to accomplish. I don't.
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brownscomb, is it Brownscomb?
Yep.
Okay. In the bill, I'm looking at Section 2, Subsection 4C. It says the harvesting of forest products from federal forest lands within this state is likely to result in the forest products being processed within this state. Does that mean that the harvester of the forest products, if they want to, they can ship those logs overseas to be processed?
So, Chair Robin, Senator Close, right. On federal land, there's federal and state public lands. Trees harvested on those grounds cannot be shipped raw overseas.
Okay, thank you.
So, and as well as that, when that was in there, it was because a number of these forests are close to Idaho, and they may have the only processing plant close enough to get it marketed to.
Okay.
Correct, Senator Roblin, and also Senator Roblin, Senator Close, Washington State,
yeah, Washington
across
too.
From the Northeast Oregon forests. One national forest, for example, the Umatilla, is partly within the state of Washington. So I think that's the other reason for the language.
I see. Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to put this on the record. Have you please put this on the record? Since we're talking about a loan from the road funds, what happens to the roads in the sense of the ability to actually maintain the roads? I'm assuming there's going to be some balance, because I understand we want to realize more by making this investment, and more is going to be coming in, but it just seems that if we're taking money that is now being used to maintain some infrastructure, if I heard that correct.
Well, I don't, that's not where the state bill is going. That's just what we talked about with the county, and at least right. in Grant County, and we're rather unique. We have probably close to $60 million in a road reserve.
Okay.
And our intent was to run off the interest, and that's why we need to protect the principal and get some interest, right. because we that's what we need to do.
Okay, thank you.
And just a note, because I think a lot of people get up to, when they hear $60 million in a road fund in a county, people need to understand that that money comes in, it can only have been spent in certain ways. And one bridge goes out, and $60 million doesn't seem like a lot of money. So
it doesn't go very long.
it's really wise for our counties to actually have a reserve that can take care of the emergencies that take place. And you have a bad winter, it can cause you a lot of money, too.
Mm-hmm. So,
thank you. Any other questions for this group? I want to thank you all for being here and getting this conversation going so we can maybe figure out where we're going to go next. We'll talk with our administrator and see if we can get a hold of you guys in the future to sit down and start having some conversations, and I may get a hold of some congressional delegations to see if we can have a conversation about them changing just a little bit so that if it can produce the value, can they pay it back? So I think that's another conversation we can have. So thank you very much for being. Is there anybody else there that wanted to speak to this that did not sign up? Not seeing any, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 257, and thank you very much, and especially for coming from a couple miles away.
Oh, yeah. Let me do that.
Yeah. So right now, one of the issues that we talked about a while back was the ONC lands and having a conversation about that, and we have a gift from our good senator to some of our members, and I just want to let him say that right now.
So since this committee is going to be dealing with a lot of these issues in forestry, I've already gotten a couple of these books. It's called Saving Oregon's Golden Goose, and it's on the history of the ONC lands. I've gotten one to Senator Prezansky and to Senator Roblin, and I have a couple here for our other two senators, Senator Close and Senator Burdick. And it'll really give you a good history of that issue and a good baseline. And there's, I think Mark Hatfield has some things in there and a couple other legislators. So it's a very good book, and I highly recommend reading it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm about two-thirds done. It's really great history. So I think all Oregonians should know about this, actually, because it's a unique part of Oregon's history. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 31. And we have a short message here, and as that's happening, Doug and Nancy from ODF can come on up. And there's room. Mike, you want to come on up as well from OFIC? So with that,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 31 allows representatives of forest land owners or, when applicable, representatives of grazing landowners to be appointed on forest land classification committees. It also authorizes the state forester to intervene and appeal and defend forest land classification committee orders. There is no revenue impact on this bill, and there's no minimal fiscal impact.
Minimal fiscal impact. So with that, Nancy.
All right, great. Well, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Bert Sugar, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hurst, Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry. Joining me at the table from also the Department of Forestry is Doug Graff, who will help in providing some testimony here. I just have a couple comments to touch briefly on to try to frame this up a bit, and that's just a very brief refresher on the department's mission as it relates to fire protection, which each of you, in having had conversations with most of you, are very, very familiar with, but I think it's important, especially following the previous conversation, the role and the mission that we have in protecting just about 16 million acres of forest land in Oregon. And we do that through a complete and coordinated system, and we accomplish that with our landowner partnerships and with our cooperators. The second piece I'll touch on just briefly is really what is forest land classification or the purpose of it. And it's a very important component of the overall policy framework in which we operate in providing fire protection in Oregon. The purpose of forest land classification is to provide for a fair and equitable payment of the state's base fire protection services. And Thereby, the department administers the statutes related to that system. So I'm going to turn it over to Doug, and he'll highlight the two kind of components of the bill that propose some changes to the current system.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Deputy Chief, Fire Protection Division for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Before you have my testimony, and I'll highlight the two key points which represent the adjustments to the current statutes on the forest land classification. The first change restores an unintended language change that resulted from the passage of Senate Bill 189 in 2009. This Senate bill was a complete review of the forest land classification language, and the change relates to the committee makeup for the Forest Land Classification Committee. The unintended language change relates to, let me back up half a second, from mid-60s, to give you some history on the change, from the mid-60s to 2009, the law required that county governing bodies appoint at least one forest landowner or representative of a forest landowner and one grazing landowner or representative of a grazing landowner if the protection district contained grazing land. So that was the language that was in from 1960 to 2009. The language that was omitted in the adjustments in 2009 was the or representative of the landowner. So the resulting change affect the committee makeup in this way. This adjustment did not allow, for example, a timber company to submit an application to the county commission for appointment of a forester working for the timber company to be a member of that committee. Or, for example, a county who manages and owns timberland, it removed their ability to appoint, say, the county forester to the committee. So that's the language, the first adjustment to the language. So remedies and oversight within that adjustment in 2009. The second change to the bill adds language that allows a state forester to intervene in a court of appeals resulting from forest land committee orders. Currently, the statute is clear that allows a citizen's appeal from a classification committee decision to the circuit court. What the current legislation does not state is indicate who can provide the defense. So the Senate Bill 31 before you adds language which allows the state forester to intervene and assist the counties in defense through the use of the Department of Justice in the event of an appeal. The reason this language is before you, we shedded some light on this topic a few years ago when we had an appeal in Wallowa County. Subsequently, the appeal was ultimately dropped, but it shedded light that it was not clear within the current legislation that the state forester can support the counties in the defense through the use of the Department of Justice if that case were to take place. Furthermore, was not clear how the department would engage in that appeal with respect to an issue in forest classification being a statewide issue and really dealing with that at a circuit court level. So the interest there is to allow support to the counties in the event of an appeal. Both changes address factors that may limit participation in the committees as currently written. As a result, these changes are important to effectively implement the forest land classification system. And to close, the department again thanks the committee for the opportunity to express its support for Senate Bill 31 and stands ready to assist in any way to finalize the bill. And with that, we'll take any questions.
So we wanted to ask questions, or should we have Mike go first? Okay. But we'll finish up with Mike. Thank you.
All
right. Thank you, Chair Roebling, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. As a participant on the year-long process back in 2009, a forest land classification review committee, we traveled all over the state, made some excellent recommendations, found consensus agreements on what is and what isn't necessary for protection in timberlands and grazing lands. The first issue before you today is the inadvertent miss of or representative of, which I think is a necessary mix. As you can imagine, our larger member companies have a number of foresters. The Allen Fords of the world can't always participate on every committee in the county. So we're behind that 100% after a couple of years of implementation in a variety of different counties. As Mr. Graff has indicated, the final recommendation for the state forester to be able to intervene is coming from practical application of the bill a couple seasons into it. So on behalf of OFIC and our member companies, we support the changes.
So questions? I see none. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who did not sign up who would like to testify on the Senate Bill 31? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 31. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 31. And I would accept a
motion.
Motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 31 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Bertschinger, let me go through this again. Moves that Senate Bill 31 be moved to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. So ordered. And to carry this bill? Do you want to carry this one?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Bertschinger. So that closes that hearing, and we will now move on to a public hearing on Senate Bill 422. And with that, yes, Lane County, come on forward. We'll have a short explanation of the bill from our administrator, so Raquel, and then we'll have our member here as well speak to this one. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 422 authorizes rural fire protection districts and state or local law enforcement agencies to enter into contracts for agencies to provide a special level or type of law enforcement service. It outlines the provisions the contract may include.
And with that, I think we'll start out with Senator, do you want to start and introduce?
That would be great if I could.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you very much. So, colleagues, this bill, Senate Bill 422, is before us at the request of Sheriff Tom Turner. Tom is actually back in Washington, D.C., taking care of business, so he cannot be here today. I'm very happy that Captain Trapp from the Lane County Sheriff's Office was able to work in his schedule to be here today to do the presentation. But I'll give you kind of a overview. I was asked to meet with the sheriff and a couple of the rural fire districts in Lane County regarding the problem that some of the rural fire districts found themselves in, basically trying to provide the services that they are supposed to provide in their rural fire districts, such as responding to fires or more likely medical emergencies, where they have been told or learned very quickly before getting to the property that the property was not, quote unquote, secure, and there could be a threat still at the location. And as you can imagine, we have firefighters and medical personnel that are not trained to actually intervene as law enforcement and police services, and for their own sake and for the liability of the fire districts, they basically would not go into the property until they actually had law enforcement and sense of police services available to secure the area to ensure the safety of everyone. And so I will stop with that to allow the captain to go forward, and then I may have some other comments based on some feedback I've gotten in the, this earlier today.
And again, I want to say thank you for being here, and don't forget to identify yourself for the record as you get started. But thank you, Bull. Thanks for being here. Either way.
Chair Roebling and members of the committee, I am Captain Byron Trapp with the Lane County Sheriff's Office. You have Sheriff Turner's written testimony. but let me tell you what this bill will do. First, I'd like to thank Senator Prozanski for putting this forward. Just a little history of how we've gotten to this point is the Lane County Sheriff's Office over the series of years has suffered significant budget reductions and has greatly impacted the public safety service delivered by the Sheriff's Office. For the last 2 years, we have had have not had 24-hour police coverage in unincorporated Lane County. The state police has similarly limited staffing in Lane County and, in fact, just recently reduced their staffing even further. This provides for currently 16 hours of rural law enforcement provided in Lane County, which leaves 8 hours of every day where there's no law enforcement on duty in the unincorporated parts of Lane County. And obviously this creates many occasions of a very delayed police response to calls for service. And our partners in public safety in the community, their rural fire departments, frequently rely on joint deployments with police and fire to many scenes. Some of them are crime scenes, some of them are just have a scene of violence or potential violence that causes the fire staff to rely on law enforcement to provide for a safe scene for them to enter and provide medical care and treatment to those involved. This bill essentially will allow for the fire districts to contract for law enforcement services within their districts and help them achieve their mission safely. This provides the option similar provided to essentially city governments within the county. We have contract services for law enforcement for city government where they are small towns that don't have sufficient resource to provide their own independent law enforcement agency, and they contract with the sheriff. We provide their city law enforcement. So this would be very similar to that. This bill would not require fire departments or fire districts to do anything different. It just provides this as an option for them. A couple of the department or districts that we have through a current federal grant have a resident deputy that is due to essentially defund in about 1 year from now. And the interest was brought up as the senator spoke through a couple of the fire chiefs with the sheriff that recognizing the value provided by those resident deputies, if there was an alternate method of funding those resident deputies to maintain them in those rural communities, the interest is there on some of the fire districts. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. And just to, I thought the previous testimony from your other panels was really sort of related in that today, actually, Lane County and a number of other counties in Western Oregon actually received their last payment from the federal government for secure rural schools. So that act, which began in year 2000, is really gone now. It's been in a declining mode over about the past 5 years, steeply declining, and it's really set up the situation that we have now with respect to public safety in Lane County and indeed many of the other counties. The Board of County Commissioners on Tuesday will take their final action. We hope to put a measure out for the public to provide funding for the Lane County Jail and critical youth services. But the issue is that the appetite in Lane County for ability to pay taxes is such that that funding is only available for the jail or will be proposed to be only available for the jail and for youth services. But we found an awful lot of interest in polling that the public's very concerned about the lack of 24/7 patrol, as Captain Thrapp has indicated. And what I think that this bill does and a number of other measures that the legislature has looked at and passed in the past several sessions has really allowed us to find some creative ways to at least provide some degree of patrol out there. And I just note, if you haven't seen it, the governor did send a letter today to the federal delegation outlining the outcome of his 14-panel group on the ONC lands. And one of the things that he says is that, you know, it's really that the state and local governments can do what they can. The federal government needs to do what it can as well. And if we're able to do a local measure, if the state's able to come through with some of these kinds of policy measures that allow for some additional patrol. I think we've got a good story to go back to D.C., which we will be doing. Lane County goes in April to say we've done our thing, and once again, we're asking the federal government to do theirs. You know the importance of the ONC revenue. It does pay for public safety in Lane County, unlike the situation that Judge Webb was describing over in Grant County. Those dollars are supported public safety in Lane County for since 1937. So thank you, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
I have a question.
Yes. Senator Close.
Captain, can you tell us in your test or in Sheriff Turner's testimony, he talks about fire personnel are being placed in situations that are unsafe. Are these not just fires? Are they crime scenes? Or what would the police be doing as they come to the fire?
Yeah, Sheriff Roblin and Senator Close, yeah, in most cases, they're not, you know, like a just a simple medical call at a private home or a house fire. House fires, often there's a request for law enforcement to help, you know, traffic control and other measures. Most of these, where there's significant safety factors present, is where you have an active dispute, a fight, a gunshot wound. There's a critical need for very rapid treatment and patient transport. Many times it can be very life-saving or a life threat if it's not provided safely. You have that type of a scene where you are unable to determine the location of the aggressor, where the person with a firearm is, where the person with whatever weapon, non-firearm weapon that may have caused injury is located, and whether they're still on the property or not. Most of the rural fire departments are nearly all volunteer, and they're not staffed or trained with the ability to respond in a law enforcement function and provide for their safety and the safety of the people that they're providing treatment to. And those are, by and large, the types of cases, and they're not infrequent. They happen with fairly frequent events throughout unincorporated Lane County.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Beshear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would also a suspicion of arson or a fatality that was involved with a fire, would that also be part of that?
Well, it would. And I think the concept here is that should a district opt to fund a deputy through their district revenues, that deputy would be available for all of the services that, you know, as the contract would specify the terms and availability. And as it is today, without the presence of sufficient staffing of law enforcement in the county, when the fire districts do call for assistance on suspicious fires, arsons, or other circumstances, it's a challenge to coordinate those resources. The sheriff's office does have one trained deputy in arson investigation. He is significantly trained, but he's one deputy for the county. And so there's a significant coordination between the fire marshal's office and the fire district staff and law enforcement to conduct those investigations.
Other questions to this panel? Yes, Senator Pazanski.
What I want to do is just put a couple of things on the record because I have been asked as to the intention, and I think Captain Trapp has put it forward. It's basically to provide the rural fire districts the explicit authority to contract with local law enforcement for specific police services. This does not mean that Lane County or any other contracting law enforcement service is going to say to the contract district, that's your services, we're not going to be responding with our regular patrol. I mean, if they are available, they're going to be there. Well, we also understand that there would be actual agreements that normally this is how it's done, and the captain can correct me. With the city of Crestwell and the city of Bonita are two of the cities that have these type of services now provided through Lane County Sheriff's Office. If for some reason there is a major incident that occurs, they can in fact pull a deputy out of that contract and put them somewhere else if it is to that level. So it's not going to be, they can not go outside of that district, but their primary job under the contract will be to provide services within the district. So the win-win, and I've got a number of constituents in throughout Lane County in different parts that have actually emailed me with responses, thank you for doing this, because they understand that they can get a better, quicker response by having someone there that's local. It's like a resident deputy. And then the reality is that if they want to actually pay for that service, we're going to give them the tool to make that occur. And it's not, this is not a means that are with any intention to undercut any other type of intergovernmental contracts that may have been entered. I know that there's been some concern that this is somehow going to jeopardize other, let's say, collective bargaining that's occurred through another contract or whatever. That is not the purpose of this. This is only to give the opportunity for a rural fire district where their citizens want to pay for that service to be able to have somebody that would be functioning just like a rural resident deputy.
And currently that, the ability to do that is a question. Is cities can do that, but because you said, I think that there are some relationships with some cities out there that do this, but it's not explicit that the ability for a special district would have, including a fire district, this one, has that same authority. Is that correct?
If I can, we actually talked about that in some detail, and we spoke to one of the attorneys who actually represents many of the special districts and fire districts, and they said it's not clear. Okay. They said you could possibly do it, but it's a questionable issue, and before we actually would put a rural fire district in the position of maybe making the wrong decision based on how it could be interpreted in a court of law, we felt that this would be a way to make it explicit, right. And it's only, let's say, potentially another tool that they can garner if they choose to pay for that service.
Yes.
Senator Roblin and Senator Brzezinski, I'd just like to build on the testimony that Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, that Senator Brzezinski brought up, which is we do have existing contracts with the smaller cities. As the sheriff's office was shrinking here over the past several years, in fact, we've gotten concerns expressed from those cities that we're not, that their concern is that they have a contract with us to provide services within those city limits, and to the extent we are losing deputies, they feel that their service level would be threatened. So the other nice thing about this bill is that it would allow for, in a more rural area that the fire district covers, there would actually be resources there, and it really should help us, help the smaller cities feel more comfortable that their deputies will stay inside the city limits, and the rural areas will have their own resources. So it really does help the department in that respect as well.
Yes. Chair Roblin, and I would just respond as well. And
name again, too.
Captain Byron Trapp, Lane County Sheriff's Office. Thank you, sir. Just to clarify, that there is essentially a mutual aid with the city contracts. We essentially view the city contract as the city police department. And so with all police departments and law enforcement agencies within any region, but certainly in Lane County, there are formal and written and also informal and unwritten interagency support or interagency mutual aid concepts in place. And so we have the same concept with the contracted law enforcement of the cities of Bonita and Crestwell. The overriding principle is that the contracted deputies work 40 hours a work week inside the city on city law enforcement business. And then the circumstances where they would leave the city would be for a mutual aid response, whether it's to another deputy sheriff outside the city or another police agency outside the city. And so just to make sure that it's understood that if a fire district was to contract with the sheriff's office for one or more deputies, it would be the same concept. Those deputies would be obligated under contract to provide a full work week of service within the contract, subject to the mutual aid provisions. And then conversely, if there is no deputy on duty in one of the contract cities, and they have a call for service that has some urgency that can't be unattended, then county law enforcement from General Lane County Sheriff's Department services provide that service to the city with no extra cost. When the city has a homicide, we send our detectives team down there and provide those additional services at no extra cost. That's just part of what's built into the contract model. So if a fire district had a deputy sheriff on contract and there was a major crime or the deputy sheriff was on vacation or unavailable to respond, the sheriff's regular patrols as available would be responded based on the priority of the crime. We'd call people out if we're not on duty and those kinds of things. Would still continue. It would just be an enhancement to their law enforcement service within that fire district.
Any other questions? We did not post for a work session, but we will probably, we will put this on the agenda to do so in the near future. I'm looking at the schedule. It may work out to be the 14th, but we'll get that on the schedule, and we appreciate all the people. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify who currently has not had an opportunity? Yes, please do.
Chair Roblin, committee members, my name is Bob Livingston with the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I represent the paid firefighters in Oregon. I also am a firefighter in my other day job. So while I appreciate this bill, and we don't have a particularly position on the bill, I do appreciate the comments from Senator Prozonsky. A couple of things that I think from those that know me, one of the issues that has been really important to my organization is issues of safety, and we've had many battles on safety. And I would hope in the interim, as particularly in these rural areas where you may not have as many capabilities from a training standpoint, that in the interim, while these are probably local policy issues, a couple of thoughts that come to mind. One, I would hope that the chiefs and the fire district board members, as well as the sheriffs, when there are those instances where there's a threat, a 911 call, a threat, and where there needs to be a quick response, that those would certainly be priority calls. And I can just give you an experience is that we have a very good working relationship with the jurisdiction with when I work in, and when we ask for police services, we get a pretty good response. But if we don't, we also make the decision to stage and say, hey, that's a policy decision that the voters have decided with the tough difficulties and limited resources. So my point is, I hope in the interim, maybe this is somewhat of a fix. I think there also should be some discussions to assure that all public safety officers are safe and that everybody's on the same page as we go forward. The other comment that I would like to make is ironically, I would suspect, and I think there are some people from the fire service in the room, is that the funding issues that are there for law enforcement, the very same issues are there. So this is a little bit of we're taking from Peter to give to Paul, but it all hurts the fabric of the total, you know, frontline first response. And so I think there's some underpinnings in some of those things that you discussed in previous bills. I think there's going to be discussions this bill on, you know, things such as Measure 5 and 47 and property tax issues that also probably fit into this mix as well. And so with that, you know, I think some of these are left up to the policy decisions of those. But ironically, it seems strange that, you know, you're going to fund for fire district services to provide law enforcement services, and those are both taxpayer dollars. And I for one, never have pitted law enforcement against fire service, and I don't think this is the intent of that bill. It's the irony of the situation that we're at hand. And so in the interim, I hope that, you know, like I think my organization does, we want to continue to work with our stakeholders in the law enforcement side, fire service side, the whole public safety community to try to solve these challenging problems and provide the best service that we can to our communities.
I appreciate that. Any questions? No. Thank you very much for that. And I absolutely agree with you. This is an issue of the lack of resources that all of our communities are finding themselves in, and trying to figure out how do we help each other and protect those things is really, really important. And it's a sad choices that we're being forced to make these days. And it, as it turns out, in listening to our law enforcement, we have more serious and more often than we probably realize situations out there where it takes the combination of both services to make people safe in doing their jobs, and that's.
You know, and I'll just put this, you know, I guess on the record. In my discussions at town halls, we actually had individuals that are volunteer firefighters that say they pack, they carry with them on their task because they're concerned for their safety where they don't have law enforcement available. And, I mean, the reality is I don't know if their departments or districts know they're doing that as to what the liability potential is. But clearly we do not need and we do not want our first responders that are trained for firefighting or for medical purposes to have to be engaged in law enforcement, police services. I mean, it really mixes it up to the point of where they're not able to concentrate and focus on what they're best trained to do.
especially since they're not trained for law
enforcement. That's right, exactly. Okay, with that, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 422. And that concludes all the things that we've had. Any comments or suggestions or anything anybody wants to say at the end of the meeting? Then, pardon?
See you Tuesday.
See you Tuesday, that's right. So, again, appreciate all the people for being here, and we are going to adjourn our committee meeting for today.